I'm sure that a good number of you have already gotten acquainted with Dr. Edmonds, but he's such a quiet, congenial fellow that unless you ask him a lot of things about himself, he won't talk about himself, but he'll sure do a lot of talking about the area and the country about you and him. Dr. Edmonds is the head of the theology department at Augustana, Rock Island. And he also is the chairman of the Division of Science at Rock Island. He's had quite a unique background and experience, having been a geologist with the oil companies for 7 years, and then having been vice president of Standard Oil Division of Ohio Division, is this correct? Standard Oil of Ohio. So-hio, isn't it? That's the way they put it. So his background and experience in geology, in management, in teaching, all the way is quite a unique one, and I think we have a privilege, real privilege, of having him then handling this period and sharing with us for the remainder of the week. Dr. Edmonds, we won't take any more time.
Thank you. Well, Dr. Hubbell has set the stage here for us, and we want to take off from where he left off. At the same time, I want to make it clear that the conflict, you know, he has the gods up here conflicting with one another, and I, in no sense, am going to try and compete with him up here on the stage, because I admit he has already won the battle. So we'll start out from this point. My assignment is to deal with science. And in that sense, we're going to start off right with what we have on the board here. Now, the only thing that appeared up here was something about scientific literature and science treatise and this sort of thing. He didn't in any sense try to define science or what this kind of activity is. But I think the first and most important thing to realize at the outset about science is that science is human activity. That is, there is no science outside of the mind of man. And this is something that has grown up along with all of these things that we've been talking about. This is a part of our culture, a part of our activity. It is a part of man. And therefore, if we look at science as such, scientists do organize and try to systematize, and they deal with certain factors where they have qualifications. Now, we would like to get somewhat specific about what a scientist is and what science really does. First of all, the science itself, just taking the broad category of science, scientists deal with the natural world and the natural phenomena, you see, that exist, the laws of nature, and all of the things that pertain to the natural world. And what does he do in his work with these things? Because he does deal mainly with things. He works with nature in an attempt to discover what is there. And at this point, you see, he starts out really with God's creation. And what he is doing is not creating as such. He is simply trying to discover what has been created, how it operates, and what we can learn about it. And then proceeds from this point on to organize, systematize, and use this knowledge. So science is really a body of knowledge, and it is an organized, systematized body of knowledge. And it deals with the natural phenomenon then of the world. The scientist then is a human being, believe it or not. Some of you wouldn't think so, you know. You have various pictures in your mind of what a scientist is. And they run the gamut, of course, and what you generally remember about the scientist is that he's a person who likes to get off by himself and work with things and think, you know, and oftentimes you get the picture of a scientist working hardest when he has his feet up on the desk and looking out of the window. He's trying to figure out something, you see, about how these things operate that he may have studied and learned about. So the scientist is very often pictured in your mind as an introvertish sort of guy that gets off by himself, and he's interested in things, not interested in people as such. I don't think this is necessarily true, but this is often the picture that you have. And the day when the scientist was mainly in the background, was back in the laboratory, he was the kind of a fellow that worked down the basement or back in the back corner someplace. And he was tinkering with various kinds of things to discover what the world is all about. And then as we have progressed through time and in the development of this knowledge, the scientist has gradually come out of the back corner in the basement, and now he's pretty much up in front in many ways. And I think it's important that we have this opportunity to explore together the role, really, of science in our culture today. And so it'll be our purpose in these lectures that we have, the time that we have together, to try and open up the field of science to you in what I hope will be a kind of a synthesized way, so that you get an overview of what science really is, how it affects your life, and what you have to do about it, and in what way are you engaging in this scientific effort, because there is a way in which you now become very, very directly involved. And this was not true in the past. There was a great gulf that separated, oftentimes, the scientist and other people. Now, this is no longer true, and therefore, it is important that we do understand something about it specifically. Well, I'd like to just outline for you, then, the things that I see. And this is my own personal view, and I can't speak for all of the scientists and by any means, and I'm sure that I have some in my audience here, that how many of you do engage in either the teaching of science or practice it as a profession? Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Well, you see there's a dozen here or more. And you will have your own opinion, and you'll get an opportunity to express it. So we'll go along and see if you can agree with at least some of the things that I say, and then we'll elaborate from that point on. First of all, science, then, starts out with this chaos. You see, the world to man is chaos until you begin to organize it and systematize it. And what does the scientist do? He engages in activity which tends to bring together these odds and ends. First of all, he is an observer, and presumably a good observer. And he observes impartially. He simply records and observes what he actually finds. And in doing this, you see, he's trying to discover the orderliness of nature, and to see if this chaos can be reduced to some kind of order. Now, in doing this, what has he done? He started out first with his naked eye, and he had no tools. And if you go back in the early history of man, he had mainly his curiosity and his mental stimulus. The very fact that he was a man, he wanted to discover, and he wanted to learn about the environment in which he lived. This is the drive and the curiosity that gets him into this kind of activity. Then what does he do? He observes everything he can observe with his eye. and all of the things that we have up here, from the myth and so on. He tries to explain in whatever way he can, but the scientist, if he's really scientific, tries to stick with his own field of the natural and the natural phenomena. And I think it's important at this point to clarify the field of science from the point of view of its authority. Under what authority do scientists operate? And what is their highest authority? The highest authority for science is the laboratory, or the field, the observation. And it's simply being able to observe and reduce these things to an orderly way of looking at them, and then being able to repeat this in the presence of peers or people who know what you're doing. And so if you want to prove something to a scientist, you go to the laboratory to repeat what you have observed and show that this is exactly what happens. Or you go to the field and you show him the rocks and the sequence of the building of the mountains or whatever it might be. And if you can convince your peers that you are on the right track, this is the highest authority. There is no authority beyond this. So the scientist deals then with an activity where he engages in this sort of thing, and he subjects everything that he does to the scrutiny and criticism of everybody else who is engaged in this kind of activity. And this then is the element as far as the authority of science is concerned. So he has now examined everything he can see with his eye and tried to begin to organize it. He's also worked down into the smaller units, down to the atom, you see, by using instruments. And he's also enlarged his eyesight, not only to see smaller things, but also to see much bigger things out into the universe, into this chaos beyond the earth itself, where we live. And as you can see, a great deal has been accomplished just in the observation end of this. What does he find as he observes these things? He finds that there is an order, and science is built on the orderliness and the faith and the assumption that there is always order. And it's this basic order that the scientist works with then. And he finds that even as he looks down to the atom, to the smallest thing he can observe in the laboratory and work with, even though he can't see it, it has a pattern of order. And we can liken the order of the atom to the order, for example, of our solar system, and the Earth traveling around the Sun, and the Moon traveling around the Earth as the Earth travels around the Sun. So the atoms and the smaller units seem to have, and in the laboratory you can observe that they have an order, and things are put together. Whether you look at the universe at large, a galaxy and many galaxies, or whether you look at the Earth and the solar system, whether you look at an atom and its electrons and various parts, you see you can find in all of this activity an order. Now this kind of thing gives the scientist his base from which he operates then. We also believe that into this system of order came life, you see, with also an order in it. And life is not chaotic. As we look back through time and through the ages past, there is an order. And the order is very clearly recorded. And it's with this that we'll spend a special lecture just dealing with the life part of this, as we look not only at modern biology and zoology and so on, but let's look back, take a backward look as far back as we can look into the history of the Earth from the point of view of life itself. So all the sciences are interrelated. And this becomes particularly apparent in my own field of geology. Now, geology is the putting together, really, of all of the sciences and applying them to the history of the earth. And really what we're trying to find out in geology is what has happened in the past, and to then be able to look at the future in terms of not only the present, but the past. And our key is to look at the present and use all of the science that's available to us. We use the most sophisticated physics that we can apply to this unraveling of this chaos. And we use mathematics, we use chemistry, we use everything that's developed in all of the fields, and then try to use this in relationship to understanding the earth. Now, in dealing with science, I've said that it is human activity, and it's really the progress of science is related to man's own progress himself from the point of view of his mental activity. And the ability to be free, for man to be free in his thinking, is one of the greatest and most important things to a scientist and to science as it has developed. It has not always been the case that scientists, people engaged in this kind of probing into the natural phenomena of the world, had freedom to think. There have been times when the church has put a pretty heavy paw, you see, on what kind of activity people engaged in. And the scientist is not trying to find out anything except the truth, you see. And it's a phase of truth that we're interested in our total human activity. But perhaps more at the present time than any time in the past, man is free to think and to do. But this is not to say that there shouldn't be perhaps restrictions. And this is one of the things we should ponder together. How far do you go in this kind of freedom? Do you let the scientists have full rein? Do we want to know the whole truth? You see, these kind of basic philosophical questions, not only philosophical, but theological questions, come to our mind. And we'll have to deal with them as we approach this subject. Well, let's talk about after we admit that this is mental activity, and it's engaged in by people, then let's look at the tools of science. First of all, the eye is the most important in the beginning. This is where you start. Now, from the eye, we have simply built microscopes to look down at smaller and smaller things. And now we're at the point where we're observing things in the laboratory which we can no longer see. And we're working in a realm of physics and chemistry and even biology now, the point where we can no longer actually see. What we measure, we can never demonstrate except through its measurement. And we are down so fine, you see, at what we're looking at. You can take a hand lens, and I carry a little one in my pocket usually when I travel around here to look at the rocks, and I can magnify them 10 times. Well, this helps me identify them. Now, through the electron microscope, you can go up to hundreds of thousands of magnification. And now, through a microprobe and various things, we get this up into fabulous figures in terms of the minuteness of the size of particle we can observe and how it's put together. This gives us a whole new world to work with, just as a result of new tools which have come out of the physics department, you see, optics and all of this, electronics and everything, to get at the smaller particles. Now man can put his mind, you see, right into the atom and right into the cell of life, to the point that he can figure out how the cell is put together, something that you can't see, or how the atom is put together. And he can observe it, he can measure it, and he can show his contemporaries what he's doing, and they can follow. You as a layman can't. And this is one of the great difficulties we have, is this gulf that exists in this kind of activity. Now, if we go to the other extreme, what are we doing? Let's look at the world beyond, and see, beyond our Earth. Well, first we made a very simple telescope that you could look at the moon and blow it up to where you could begin to see some of the features. And all of you have had this experience, I'm sure, of looking at the moon. And now we get pictures of it from various sources, you see. But then the telescope, with all of its perfections, has been greatly expanded now by the use of radar and this kind of thing. So we're probing out into space now with new instruments and getting information back that we don't know how to interpret. But you see, the beginning is simply we observe what we're getting back. Maybe what we get back after we observe it over a period of time will begin to fall into a pattern. This is what we're hopefully engaging in, and we're hoping that we will see some kind of order out of this. And we now know that we get back certain sounds, certain noises, certain reflections from back out into space that we have no way of relating these to anything at the present time. We don't know what they mean. But someday, maybe we will. As we get out of the way on these satellite journeys, you see, that we're engaging in now, sending out instruments, getting information back, we'll send man out. He will be the prime observer. As he travels through space, he'll send us back. What will we do with it? Well, that remains to be seen. We're simply trying to get to the top of the next mountain to find out what's new. And this is man. This is man's curiosity, and you can't stop that. So he goes on, and he goes on. The next thing I think we need to think about is language. Now, the language we mentioned up here is the language of mathematics. This is really the scientist's language. He puts everything down in terms of mathematical expression, symbols, concepts that can be communicated to scientists around the world. And whoever the scientist is, whether he's Russian, United States, or any place else, he can read the language of the science. So there is a community of scholars here in the scientific world, which is ever increasing, and there's an interchange here. Science cannot live in a little cooped up area. In order to expand and to build, it has to take all the new findings from every area, every part of the world, every mental activity that's going on in this area, and it gets published in one of these scientific treatises. And I'm sure some of you have had the experience of picking something up off of the library shelf, and you just get past the first page and you find a whole string of formulas. Well, this is where you close it up. And it's just a new world, you see. And even the sophisticated scientist has difficulty in reading the symbolism and the language that science is creating in this area. So this is not helping the layman understand what the scientist is doing. And it's only when we can get together and communicate some of these ideas that we really have any chance of coming together and really the kind of activity that we're engaged in. So we have a language of mathematics, which immediately throws up a barrier to most people. Even modern math. Your kids are bringing home modern math now, you see, and you hardly know how to cope with it. And this sort of thing. So it's a whole new problem. Now, let's look at the field of locomotion. in terms of science. You can plot this on a graph any way you like, or just think of it. Think from the earliest locomotion of man. You can run, you walk. And beyond that, you see, if he wanted to go faster, what did he do? Well, he finally got onto a horse and was able to control a horse. And he could get a little faster. But you see, this has come along very slowly until we began to make machines. And when we started to make machines, then you see the gasoline motor and all of this, the mechanized type of thing. We got our speed up to a few miles per hour. And this is much better than the horse and buggy days. But you see, until we came to the airplane, and now to the jets, and now we're breaking sound barriers and traveling, and we're in the stage of building, you see, airplanes that get you to any part of the world in just a matter of hours rather than days and months. So there's been a whole breakthrough in the area of locomotion that has come out of science as a technology. This is not science. There is a specific difference between science and technology. Technology is simply the application of scientific principles to the things that man wishes to apply them to. In other words, they take science, take the basic things that we've learned about in various areas, and then applied them to things that men wanted. We wanted an airplane. Now, the scientist doesn't need an airplane in that sense, you see, in his laboratory. And there's nothing further that he has simply discovered the laws of aerodynamics. Well, once these were discovered, this made it possible to build the airplane. And so the demand was for an airplane. And we use it. And we're glad the strike is settled, I guess, right now. So, this becomes a part of our daily life. And this is the technology where they take things from science and apply it to the average and ordinary life of men. So locomotion now is way beyond even the airplane. Now we send men around the Earth orbiting, you see, 17,000 miles per hour. And this is just the beginning of our travels into space, and we're simply trying to get to the top of the next mountain, out to the next planet, and this kind of thing and beyond. So locomotion is a thing that has brought the world together, and it's brought the scientists in a community, you see, in a sense, that this has been a very important factor in one of the tools. Now, let me just mention one other thing that I'm sure you probably thought about, and may have, or maybe you haven't. But in making tools, man has his mental ability, which is great. But if this were the limiting factor, he'd probably be kind of stymied in using tools. Just think of what you have here in your hand. There's no other animal that can take tools and handle them in the way that we can. We can oppose every finger against your thumb. Now, no other animal can do that. And in terms of manipulation, this is, in a sense, almost as great as the mind itself from the point of view of using tools. Now, with the use of manipulating tools we can make with our mind, we can fly faster than any bird, we can swim better than any fish or any animal in the sea, we can dig down below the surface of the earth, no other animal can do, and we can ferret out things down deep in the earth, bring them to the surface. No other animal can engage in that kind of activity. And you see, you can go on and off with this kind of thing. But you can manipulate. We can produce beautiful music, as you know, from the organ. Some people. Yeah. All of this, you see, is a part of our activity that we just take for granted. And yet, it's so important, really, in the things that we have been able to do. What has brought us to this point of the great scientific age in which we're living? And it is an age of science. I think we all must admit. Perhaps it's been said by others, and I expect it's very correct, that 90% of all of the scientists that have ever lived in the world from the beginning of time are living and working today. So that this is the great expansion, you see, of this kind of human activity. We're right in the midst of it. We have scientists all around us, everywhere you go. And they're working, and they're not back in the back corner. They're out in front, and we're demanding all kinds of things from the scientists in our modern technology, in our modern comforts and materialistic world. See, we want more of this. And who do we think can give it to us? We think the science is the person that can open up these new fields for us. So we're in the midst of this kind of an activity in a great, almost a culture in itself. And if you're interested in a sort of a provocative little book, read C.P. Snow's Two Cultures. C.P. Snow, a British author. A very stimulating little book that you can read in an evening, and you'll have something to think about the rest of your life. This little book simply points to the two cultures that are really developing. The scientific world and its culture, as he sees it, and the rest of all intellectual activity. You see, regardless of how far you go in any of these other kinds of mental activities, whether it be in any of the humanities, history, anything else, this doesn't get you any closer to understanding what the science is doing. In fact, the farther you go in many of these areas, and the farther the scientist goes in his specialization, the farther we're going apart. And yet, science, you see, is making such an impact on society, on the activities of man, that we need to look at these two cultures, and how are we ever going to get the two of them together? See, that's the question that C.P. Snow really poses, and it's worth thinking about. We have today really this explosion of knowledge in science, probably because we're now at the point where we're in a worldwide competition. A worldwide competition in this kind of activity. What started it all? Well, it's been started in many ways. Simply the interrelationships of men throughout the world have brought about this kind of activity, and the competitiveness that relates to the kinds of things that develop from science. So we find that this kind of activity is a competitive thing that's stimulated oftentimes from very remote corners of the world. Perhaps nothing triggered the modern period of science, the last few years, in the way that Sputnik did. This was a complete shocker to the scientific world, and particularly to people who were observing science in this country, to think that somebody over there could actually have done this ahead of us. We thought we were on top, you see. And we have this concept. And it was a real eye-opener. And at this point, of course, you see what happened was, when this happened, we had to get even. See, And what did we do? Well, like the good old American way, throw a lot of dollars at it, you see, and something will happen. Well, we did just exactly that, and we had literally opened the pocketbook to science in the last few years. And this is no exaggeration, because we're engaged in research and development now on a scale that you couldn't even have dreamed about pre-Sputnik. But now, you see, we're in the frame of mind, so, well, let's give them some money. Let's see what they can do. And they've literally done this. We've had the National Science Foundation. We've had all kinds of activities where all of us, have put in money into the pot and said, here, you scientists, take it to your laboratory and do whatever needs to be done so that we can out-Sputnik. And really, this is the kind of mental activity that has brought us, in many cases, to this point. Well, science, you see, when you begin to think of it along some of these lines, has induced such change into society that it's actually revolutionary, completely revolutionary. And this kind of revolution is something that we're all engaged in one way or another. What are we trying to do? We're trying to control our environment in many ways now, and sometimes it's a question of how wise we are. We get caught up every now and then. We change our environment in all kinds of ways. Man is the greatest changer, you see, of things on the surface of the earth, as well as down in the earth. And in every other way, we're trying to reshape things to our own desire. In a sense, you see, we're trying to rearrange to the point that we have to be careful, because we get to the point where we think we can rearrange everything to our own satisfaction. We can solve our problems through science. And in a sense, you see, we start out with man being a little god, with not a capital letter. But, you see, if you carry this concept too far, then you get the kind of thinking that you get in a country such as Russia, where science really becomes the thing you worship, becomes your god. And at this point, you look to the scientists to solve all your problems. And I think one of the greatest dangers we face together is the fact that we expect too much of science. And we expect too much of scientists. And this kind of activity can lead us down the wrong path. What can the scientist actually do, and what is he actually doing to invoke this kind of change? Well, just think of it in terms of energy. Think in terms of energy. What has happened since man started down this long trek of civilization? First of all, man had to live where the sun was bright and shining, and he had no clothes. He simply lived in an area where he could be comfortable. Now, as he changed his environment, or changed and controlled his environment, as soon as he learned how to light a fire and create some heat, which is energy, then he could keep warm. And when he learned how to light a fire and put it out and light it again, this was a great step forward in terms of energy. Then, you see, he could take his energy with him, in a sense, because he had the know-how to move out of the very temperate, very mild climatic areas into more hostile environments, and to control that environment. You can never live in Minnesota
or any place else. You see, you can do that.
Why say Minnesota? There are a lot of other places. But anyway, we've been confined. We were confined. But this allowed us to change our environment. We could be warm. We could be comfortable. And we've simply elaborated on this kind of activity. You see, it isn't any different from the spaceship. What do we do? We take our environment with us. We keep the body temperature just right. We orbit the Earth, and of course, we carry along everything that we need. And this is simply the next. It's a natural, logical development, you see, of technology in relationship to this kind of knowledge. Now, from the wood, he learned to burn the fossil fuels. The fossil fuel. Well, what are the fossil fuels? That's coal and petroleum and this kind of thing. And what is that? How do you get energy out of that? Well, this is simply energy that came from the sun and was stored up in plants millions of years ago. And they were simply preserved. And now man has learned how to tap this source of energy and use it. And he's used it. And so he's created this kind of an environment which he could take right along with him. You can pipe the oil, you can pipe the gas, you can ship the coal, and as long as you can get it, you see, you can have all kinds of activities that relate to technology and to the life of man. So the fossil fuels now was a very great step forward, and we're using them up at a tremendous rate today, as you know. Between now and this time tomorrow, when we get together, we will have burned up, or used up, in one way or another, 10 million barrels of oil in the United States. And if you look at the world, it's about 27 million barrels of this material, which is not being replaced. You see, anything comparable to this rate. So we're simply using it up. This is what we're drawing from the bank. And we have, and are using up, our coal supplies. So, where do we go from here? Well, here you say, ask the scientist. What's the scientist going to do about this? Well, out of a great catastrophe, really, Hiroshima and other places, we learned something specific under pressure about atomic energy. Now, this is something that people had some real qualms about who were involved in the unleashing of this kind of energy. Here we're taking the same kind of energy that we get from the sun. See, only we're making it right here on Earth. It's the same thing that's going on at the surface of the sun, from which when you walk out the door, you can feel this heat. And it warms our Earth. It makes it possible for life to live. Well, now we have found out by studying the atom in its finer relationships that it is possible to release this energy from the atom in the same way that the sun is releasing it. And so we've learned to split it, and we've learned to fuse it. And we get energy either way. And this kind of thing, you see, was a whole new step forward. Now, what are we going to do with it? See, one thing we can do is to make atom bombs. We can make hydrothermal bombs, you see, the oxygen or the hydrogen bomb. Or we can split it from the higher elements, the elements that have much greater density and so on. Simply split them up. So there are lots of things we can do with this. We can also create a source of energy here which staggers our imagination when you come to think of it. the thought that we might have enough abundance of energy, and it would be so free that if we could create it to the point that it wasn't so expensive and we had lots of it, see, then we don't have to worry about the fossil fuels. We don't have to worry about burning up our coal and our oil and this kind of thing if you can really do this. But you find that there are problems that relate to this. If you split the atom, then you contaminate the environment again. And what do you do with the contaminating part? Because you can't get all of the energy out, and you simply get a waste pile here that we've never experienced before. And so this is a whole new problem, what to do with the waste product from the splitting of the atom to get the energy. And if you fuse it, well, we don't know of any way of doing this yet without creating a big boom, you see. And we don't need energy that fast. We don't want it that fast, you see. And we want firecrackers that are small enough that we can control. And when you think of putting the hydrogen together, this creates really too big an explosion. But the scientists are meeting every year at some spot, and they have been now for several years, from all of the countries, Russia, and all of their satellites, as well as all of the rest of the world, putting their minds together, trying to create a new source of energy by fusing the atom in a controlled environment. And how do you control this? Well, here again. The temperatures are so high, they're the temperatures at the surface of the sun. What would you put a container of this kind? How would you make a container to have millions of degrees of temperature? As all the rocks melt, you see, at a few thousand degrees of temperature. Now, we're talking about millions of degrees. And how do you get this? Well, here the only way, and we've learned by the study of atoms and so on, but through magnetic fields. You can create a magnetic field, and you all played with the magnet and saw the filings and all, and this sort of thing. Well, do this on a different scale with real major magnets that are now possible to make. You can create a field which looks like nothing, and it is nothing, you see, in the sense that it doesn't have any physical boundaries that you can look at. And yet you can hold these atoms so tight and pinch them so hard that you can actually fuse them. And if we get to the point where we can do this economically, then you see we have created a source material for energy that just staggers the imagination. The water that goes right down Railroad Creek contains a certain amount of this heavy water. It's everywhere. And it's in the ocean. There's an inexhaustible supply of this sort of thing that you can convert to energy if we can find a way of doing it. Well, the scientists have not said that they, at this point, can find this, but they've said it's coming close enough that it begins to look like it may be feasible. And so here would be a whole source of new energy then that we might think of in terms of our human activity and the revolutionary things that this could produce. Instead of thinking about gasoline going home, well, you can think of creating electricity with this kind of thing and a battery. So maybe instead of a tank full of gas, you drive up and say, give me a new battery, here's my old one. And you can go 100 miles on it, or 200 miles, you see. And right now, we have little cars that we're experimenting with along this line. They look like golf carts today, but you can drive all around the city in a battery-operated little automobile. You get rid of all the smog. See, we have problems with smog. You know some of it. And you see, there are all kinds of things from a technological point of view that are coming out of this kind of revolutionary change
that is related directly to our activities in the field of science. Well, what is the role, really, of science in our modern culture? Certainly, I think that there's no question but what we are so far committed in the world to the kinds of things that science and technology have produced, that we're not about to turn around and turn about face and say, let's cut off this kind of activity. The point is, we're on the other hand demanding more of this kind of thing. And we're like the airplane, really, that starts down the runway. You finally pass a line on the runway, which the pilot knows. And beyond this point, there's no turning back, because you can't stop, you see, and beyond this point to the end of the runway. You've got to take off. Well, we're off and flying. And there's, I think, no doubt about it. I think we all realize it. So we're engaged in this kind of activity. The population explosion is related to this. You can't turn off this population exactly either. We now have 3 billion people plus on the surface of the earth and providing for them. By the year 2000, which most of us, I hope, some, will be very active and engaged in this, in our activities. At the year 2000, the population, according to all predictions, is going to double by this time. So for each of us, there will be one more. And you see, worldwide, from this point of view, the population explosion is going on. And how do we feed these people? How do we provide them with energy? And where does it all come from? Well, we're committed, you see. We say the scientists can do it, and they'll find a way out. The mind of man, you see, we have great confidence in this kind of mental activity and knowledge. Now, we're also creating a real bomb that we sit on, because we have this tremendous energy potential that we're developing. And what should we have done about it? I think there was really no question about what we had to go ahead with the Atomic Energy Commission. Operation Plowshare and operations of all kinds for the peaceful use of atomic energy, because of this kind of situation, the kind of world in which we live. And the question now is, how do we use it? How do we use it? Now, this is a problem that relates to all of us, not just to the scientists. You can point your finger at him and accuse him of bringing something into the world that is detrimental. But think of everything else that's been brought into the world, everything that we have learned through science and applied. Everything presented its problems when it was first brought about and became a part of our life. But I think there is a point at which we have to admit that at this time we are. We could have burned our fingers pretty badly up to the time we created energy from the atomic source. But you can burn your fingers and your body pretty badly and still recover. But we have now created the kind of energy and the kind of power that we literally can blow ourselves off the face of the earth. And this has had its salutary effects. In many ways, it's sobered up the thinking of a lot of people. We have more important things to think about than to just be squabbling among ourselves on petty issues. We have more important reasons to be working together as a renewed community when we understand the kind of predicament we're in. We're in a predicament, but what a wonderful thing it could be to look at it on the other side of the availability of lots of energy, a better life, all of the things we're learning about medicine and this kind of activity, the prolonging of life, the using of leisure time, and all of this sort of thing which we're confronted with as we think of our society in relationship to science. And the scientist is simply trying to learn the truth of natural phenomena and to then understand it in the point of that it can be utilized. And his thought is not a demonic one. He is simply trying to find out the truth, and he's made it available. But we have to share this knowledge together. Certainly the scientist cannot be absolved from telling the world what he has produced. And then society must pick it up at this point and make the best use that can be made from this kind of activity and kind of thing. Because it's really the people, the market, that really determines what's finally done with these things. Do we just put them on the shelf? Do we use them? Do we use them for the betterment of all of mankind? Or how can we control this kind of thing? We live in a very explosive age with wonderful challenges and the other possibility that somebody might get his finger on the trigger. Now, how do we control? This is one of our, certainly our major problems. The scientist shares with all other human activity the same goals. He's trying to find out the truth. The truth in his area relates to nature and the natural laws, natural phenomena. And then the scientist as such is satisfied. He's climbing his mountains in this way. The technologist now, who represents more the layman point of view and the market point of view, the technologist is trying to come up with the gadgets and the things, you see, that you want. And one of the things that you want is plenty of energy. The history of man is related to the development of energy. And you can just follow the chronology of history and the development of societies. They have come up, you see, on a materialistic level as there was energy available. And you can only rise so fast as you have power to do things. And man has built his tools and his power from energy. Everything has to operate, you see, on energy. You've got to have something to start with. And of course, the way we operate up here in Holden Village is to go in and eat a good meal, and then we can chug up to Heart Lake, you see, and back without any problem. This is energy. And we're simply converting the food into muscles. And then we run up the trail and back. Now, isn't any different in looking at it from a society point of view. You see, if you want to get from Spokane to Chicago by airplane, you've got to put some energy in the tank. It can be released along the course. The same as you would have to have a good many meals if you were going to hike it from Spokane to Chicago. Now, you simply put that energy in the tank, you see, in the form of fuel. That's a fossil energy. Where did it all come from? All came from the sun. Whether you put it in as gasoline, whether you put it into a mule as hay, or whether you put it into yourself as a steak. It all comes from the sun. And it's all just pent-up solar energy that we're using in different ways. And now the point is, we've learned how to bridge the gap. We don't have to have the bale of hay. We can take an atom. And we can take a little chunk, just a little chunk. And it's equivalent to 3 million times that amount of coal. So you just take this little chunk where you have so many atoms put together in a little cube. And it would take 3 million times as much coal to provide the same amount of energy. Well, this is the kind of strides we've made in the field of science. This is the impact of science on society. Now, we're engaged in a renewal opportunity here. And one of the things we should be well aware of is the kind of world in which we live and operate. And I think it's important that we turn these things over in our mind and think about them. And then think about the activities that you engage in relationship to this. Now, from the point of view of science, I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have that I can answer. And one of the most important things that a scientist can say is that I don't know. And I'll reserve that right. Because many times we do not know. Our development of science is something that's orderly and something you think of. There's one difference between a scientist, perhaps, and other people, the way you think, I think that I should mention. The scientist always leaves an out for changing his mind about anything. And he does it in a way in which he thinks ahead from this point of view, that he always accepts new evidence. There is never such a thing in science as a law that is not capable of being changed. That is, we don't think of laws as something that can't be changed. We think of laws in terms of, if you brought this into a given situation and controlled the situation, that it would always happen. See? But if the situation in any way, if we can find that there is a change that can be induced, or if there's anything new that relates to this kind of activity, it's always admitted that it could happen and the law may be changed. Well, we've had many laws in science change. And as this body of knowledge has grown up, we have discarded lots of laws. Now, society in general thinks of laws as something that's pretty fixed, and we think of it up here as we relate it to our literature and our body of knowledge. It's pretty much that way. First, we start with an idea. Then, if the idea seems to have merit, we test it. It becomes a hypothesis. And we think it usually works. And if we find that the hypothesis checks out in a great variety of situations, then we may elevate it to a theory. It's still subject to investigation as a theory. Then, if it seems to always work, then we call it a law. And we have Newton's laws, gravitation, this kind of thing. And this then is the highest level to which we raise this sort of knowledge. But we always admit that it can be changed. Now, we have modified, changed many of Newton's laws because of what Einstein discovered and because of what's being discovered today and this sort of thing. So, we have an open mind. Sometimes people think that it's too open. Everything kind of runs through. Yeah, okay, well, that's a main question. Well, a scientist would not look at this as science.
But as a scientist is two persons in one, as we all are. All of you have some kind of an occupation that you follow. And you also have a vocation, which is at a much higher level. The scientist engages in this kind of activity as his occupation. But the scientist would also read the Bible in terms of the kind of thing we're trying to get at here in relationship to gender. What is really being said here in terms of man's relationship with other men and with his God? We would think that the knowledge of the time that this was written probably was not meant to be scientific. Not scientific from the point of view of trying to control the orbits of stars within a galaxy. The sun would only be one star in a galaxy, our galaxy, you see in this case, of it's 100 million light years across. And if you took this sun and followed its path until it came around in the galaxy to the same point, it takes 200 million years. Now, we don't think that the book of Joshua, the people, whoever wrote, you see, had any particular knowledge of this at the time. And if you stop one sun in the galaxy, what do you do with all of the rest of the millions of stars that are with this? You see, nothing is said about the rest of the galaxy. So it just is not anything that is, I think, intended to be scientific. There is a message here. Now let's discover what the message is in relationship to mankind and to God, but not try to read science. Well, anyone is free to think what he wishes. And I would have no argument with what anyone would think about this kind of statement. All I am saying is my own personal reaction to this would be that I would not read this as something that relates to the natural laws of the universe. That's my interpretation, and any other scientist may wish to have his own and make.
This is
Yes, I'd be very happy to do this if there is a demand for it later in the week. Tomorrow, what I thought I would do is to deal with geologic time, and I had planned to spend Wednesday on light in relationship to geology. And if you would wish, and you might discuss this among your group, particularly the Stehekin group, we could put these two into one lecture tomorrow and then have Wednesday, and maybe take Wednesday to have a discussion of the geology of the area, the origin of the Cascade Range, and something of the mineralization that relates to the mine up here, and go through this from a geological history point of view, maybe on Wednesday. Now, if we're going to have lectures beyond Wednesday, we can work some of these things in beyond that point. And I think it'd be well if we just had some time together for questions that you might like to raise.
Would you be willing to comment or make an evaluation or assessment of our current dilemma, which is defining whether there ought to be limits on the progress of technology? Mm-hmm. For instance, research into the human brain or continuation of life after death that is being done, or maintaining a brain of, say, a great man beyond the point of his normal physical death in a laboratory. Which have been hitting our current magazines and so forth. Would you comment on that?
contrary orders. And I think a fair question. So long as activity of this kind deals in the realm of trying to learn new truth, that is, learn more about life and more about our physical world as well, seems to me this is not only justifiable activity, but very well worthwhile activity, because our living and continuing to live on this earth, I think, requires that we keep on probing into these various areas. And I think that the scientist, as such, should not be limited, really, in trying to find out all that there is about truth. After all, truth is truth, and let's not be afraid of it. But let's also keep well versed on what might be done with these kinds of truths and with this kind of new knowledge. Let's keep abreast of what is going on. You better read everything you can read about what is being done, because the test tube form of life, if you can call it life, and it depends on your definition here too, but certainly it would meet what we would call life, is very likely something that we're going to be confronted with. And this is a part of our environment now. It's a part of our knowledge. And let's admit that it's going to happen. So now, what do we do about it? We who have supported the scientists who found this out also have some power to say what should be done about it. What are we doing about the atom bomb? We're not out dropping atom bombs all over the countryside. We are trying to control it. This is another kind of atom bomb. It's a bomb that hits society in a little different way, but it's the same kind of a bomb. Now, can we use this kind of knowledge to better mankind? And here is where you, as individuals, every one of you, including me, we're all together in this, and we have to make some decisions. Now, these decisions can be made in various ways. Now,
I was thinking specifically about Mars, but I read whereby transplants from one brain to another are, at least in the realm of possibility, if they are happening already, whereby actual technology can be transferred from an aged person to a younger person, or to, so the mind is not lost. And if it can be done in the area of technology, it can also be taken from the frontal lobes of the brain and other areas, and perhaps done in the realm of conscience and the capacity of soul and spiritual thinking and so forth, which means a very good control over mind, perhaps.
That's right. And so this is not all black. Everything that I think you can think of that we have discovered in science so far, there could be a good use made of it. And I think that the most dangerous one is the one that I have elaborated here in relationship to the power that we can unleash from the atom. Now, we can do wonderful things with this, and we are doing wonderful things with it. And we've got to handle it. So let's control it. You're the people who can control it. Don't ask the scientists to do this for you. It's not their job. Because the scientist also is the citizen who has... This is our vocational overview. We have to look at ourselves as a part of society, as continuing society. And we share with you the same responsibility. If we bring it into being, and you know about it, then at this point, you see, we stand on equal ground.
In a lot of these areas, it's coming to the place where the matter of ethics is involved, say, in the realm of medical science. To what extent does say, a physician with all the scientific equipment at his disposal have a right to prolong the life of a person that is dying, but from the point of view of the personality, he's dead, he's biologically alive, but and this and other area, along this area, it seems to me that the realm of ethics, especially if the person is of inadequate means, and all the expenses involved in keeping a person biologically alive with all of these medicine or this pool, and yet at the same time there is really little hope of having recovered, say, a person that is unconscious and he just existing but not really living.
Well, this is what I mean. We're in the realm, you see, of what you do about it. The scientist helped you get to the point that you can do this. Now, should you do it? This is the basic question. And whether you should or you shouldn't, you shouldn't ask the man who simply operates the machinery that does this. There's a more basic question by far than this. And is it right? From whatever point of view you see that we might think about, you've got to face this question.
Well, doctors and ministers and in these fields of science, the people in them are getting together to discuss these things. And to me, the atom bomb is the pillar of fire which we've got to use for constructive use and to control people too.
Well, there you have, you see, the potential for control. If enough people think this way, it'll be done. Now, if there are others, you see, if there is the problem of the minority here, who may not think the same way you do, see, we have to face this reality. There are people who would rather not have people like you thinking about this. They'd rather control this from an authoritarian point of view. And this gets to be, you see, this gets to be a real problem. And we shouldn't minimize these things. That's my point. We need to be talking about it. The church needs to be so involved in this area, all of this area, because the church's people are the ones that are doing the job. Why shouldn't the church be in? There's no reason that we should stand off in the background and say, well, it isn't any of my business. The scientists are the ones that created all this mess. You provided the money. Now, the finer of what?
The finite realm.
Finite.
And its relationship to the realm of existence. Now, matter has an ordered structure.
Right.
Does the concept of divine intervention, is this contrary to science and the laws of nature?
Well, here all we could say is that as we observe nature, we see that we must have a master architect that must have designed this to make everything fit together so neatly. And yet, to be just different enough that no two of us here look alike, fortunately, I guess. no two of us act exactly alike. There are differences within the inorganic world, too, that allow nature to experiment in all different directions. I remember one of my favorite professors always put it this way, that nature never misses. because it always shoots in every direction. This is built into the architecture of all the matter and the system and the order in which it exists. And this kind of thing seems to be something that we wouldn't think that a scientist doesn't think of God as creating something that is complete chaos and disorder. Now I don't know. Further. From a biological point of view, is it possible to bring back life? Is this the question?
Well, if this story in the New Testament actually rejected by the scientists because of the idea of the laws of nature and the order of nature, the idea of something from outside intervening inside the world.
An outside intervention which would allow this to be possible. I think if you accept the concept that God created and established all order, that he might in turn control whatever he wished of this order. This is beyond any explanation or any knowledge that man would have of being able to do this. And we don't know how the order got started. We simply say that this is beyond the realm of science. We simply take the literal concept that there is a God that has created all of this. And if you say this, I suppose you could say the opposite. He could alter this at any point. At any point. And the scientists would say, have you observed this? Is there any knowledge in your fund of knowledge that tells you that this did happen in any specific instance? And if so, how did it happen? You see, this would be the scientist's function. And if he could find out how it happened and that it could be repeated and could be observed, could be described, then he could say, well, this is science. But I think this is... The question you ask is beyond science. This is not science, really. This is God you're talking about. And we're not tampering with that. We're simply trying to understand what God has created. Is that...
I just have one more question now. Could two scientists accept the idea of the God with all the nature in the...
Could a true scientist accept the fact that God could do this? Well, if he can accept the fact that God did it, I would think yes. Now, this is where you come to points of difference, of course, with some scientists. Not all scientists would say yes. Some would say, no, we don't see any evidence for this. And we therefore reject it. Now this goes beyond. But then you ask the scientist who says this, how do you explain that? How do you explain that order ever got started? And you see, the farther back you probe in science to account for this sort of thing, the more you come to feel that you cannot you can't explain it. You can't set the stage for why you can prove that the order came into existence. So you come to a blank wall in which you say, well, now, we have no answer. And I think that most scientists would simply say at this point that we don't have the answer. We don't know what it is. We work with the world as it is. The rocks and the minerals are here when I was born, and life was here And I start looking at this point. And my mind now, you see, can only probe so far back, only so deep. And then I have to say, beyond this, I don't know. And here, then, you see, then we look to a God who was the master, architect, or however you want to phrase it, however you want to put it. But you see, this gets beyond the area where we have answers. And you shouldn't expect the scientist to have an answer to this, really. Because he won't have one. But he's still a human being that deals with the same question, you see, as you do, whether you're a scientist or whether you aren't. That's why we look. We're interested in our beginning. We go as deep as we can, and when we get to the end of the road, well, we better admit that we don't know beyond this point. How are we doing?
Okay, fine. Those of you who would like to stay, there's another half hour that you could question Dr. Edmonds. Otherwise, then Wimmer has a few things to say about the empty hour, and I'm sure Dr. Edmonds is willing to continue with it if he wanted to stay here. Our new function here session, our anti-apathy hour, will be right now. We had three groups, right? One group on front of Slade 1, Springford is going, or in the general proximity. One behind Slade 5, another one in the Vesper Circle, below the schoolhouse by the creek. Now this noon, we again will remember our common task, which fits in quite nicely with the discussion from this last session. So we not only remember the scientists, but each one of our tasks within our life that isn't just the scientist that is responsible for making some of these decisions. So we not only remember the scientist in our prayers and work that he does, but that all of us will become aware of the current topics of discussion and therefore become involved in the decisions that are made. So this will be our general topic of concern within our prayers this morning.